Counsel?
We will proceed. Can you turn it up louder? Wait a minute. Can you hear this? Well, just wait a minute. Can you hear it? Can you turn it up any louder? What? Would you like to sit over here then so you can hear it better? All right. All right, you can proceed. Thank you. Counsel, did your client contact the Department of Health and Social Services and fraudulently claim that she was speaking on behalf of the entire organization instead of expressing her own personal views? Did she make it clear that these were her own personal views?
I don't think she made it clear one way or another.
Well, you can either make it clear or you can't. You can't be one way or the other.
Let me tell you what she did. She had a breakfast meeting with the acting director of the Department of Community Affairs. And at that meeting, she briefed him on several matters which were of concern to her and the association.
To her?
Beg your pardon?
To her. Well, was she purporting to speak on behalf of the association? That's what I asked you.
She was there as a representative of the association.
Was she appointed to do that, or did she do that on her own?
She did that on her own.
Okay. Counsel, you are now into your rebuttal time.
Okay.
But you can continue.
The director of the department, the individual state defendant, had a frequent working relationship with the plaintiff, and they characterized the relationship with her as cordial. The association, I think, regarded Mrs. Spencer, at least, as an adequate employee. She had received a good performance evaluation only several months earlier. Following June of 1997, I don't think it's an overstatement to say the two state officials were extremely angry at the plaintiff because of the comments she had made. She informed the president of the association that she had irreparably ruined the relationship between the association and their department, although the director of the department did not see it that way. And they indicated that they would have no further dealings with her. On at least four separate occasions, between June of 1997 and September of 1997, the state defendants informed the officials of the association and their members that the plaintiff had irreparably ruined the relationship between the association and it. Moreover, at the same time, the officials in the association changed in their relationship with the plaintiff. Most noteworthy, the president of the association, who has been a very loyal backer of Ms. Spencer, on several occasions during the summer of 1997, accused her of irreparably ruining a relationship encouraged her to resign her employment. In September of 1997, the state officials threatened to discontinue funding the operating activities of the association and told the association officials that they could not and would not deal with the plaintiff. Almost day after that occurrence, the association board met and discussed and took a no confidence vote on Mrs. Spencer, largely because of her relationship with the Department of Commerce and the Affairs. Finally, in the fall of 1997, the plaintiff was directed to prepare a contingency budget in the event funding would not be secured from the department. She did that and prepared it for presentation in the November 1997 meeting of the board.
Counsel, your time is up, but I will allow you one more minute to proceed with your thought.
Thank you. The department informed the association table that particular resolution and didn't take it up. That was curious because the last meeting the association board would have during that year, and some contingency plan would have to be in place in early 1998. At the very same board meeting, the board in executive session terminated the plaintiff's employment. Now, I suggest that all of these facts taken together would at least create a reasonable inference on the part of the jury that the state defendant, at the very least, encouraged the association to terminate her employment. Thank you very much.
Right, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Mike Kramer. This morning I speak on behalf of all of the appellees in this matter. Your Honors, before I begin what I have prepared, I want to address one thing that Mr. Baker said and what you, Judge Coffey, were asking about. I think Ms. Spencer's own testimony may shed some light on whether or not she spoke on behalf of the association, or at least ostensibly so. She testified in her deposition, "I was a spokesperson for the board, and I didn't have any personal gain in this, so I don't understand what my approach is. I didn't have personal opinions regarding the work of the association. The work of the association was the work I did. My job was to be the spokesperson for the association and for the board." And I'm reading from pages 181 and 182 under tab 1 in part 32 of the record. So I hope that addresses the idea. And you are correct, Judge Crawford, that she did not have the board's authorization to speak, but she did speak ostensibly on behalf of the association. Plaintiff Spencer indicates that there are at least five different ways that a private actor can be held accountable under Section 1983, and argues that two of them apply here. I won't focus for very long on the joint action theory because I think that the briefs cover that well. It's very clear that under this court's case law, to find joint action, there must be a conspiracy, a meeting of the minds, an agreement between the public and private actors. The public and private actors have to share a common unconstitutional goal. And here, what the record contains is the testimony of 13 people who would be in a position to know that there was no such agreement, no such meeting of the minds to terminate Carol Spencer for unconstitutional reasons. Spencer herself admitted that she had no evidence that there was any such agreement and no evidence of any instruction from the state officials to terminate her.
Why didn't the association's board of directors fire Spencer immediately upon approving the executive committee's recommendation to fire her? Is there anything?
I don't know that there's anything in the record that would cover that, Your Honor, but I believe that the reason is because they didn't want to fire her right before the Christmas holidays. They made the decision in November, and their next regularly scheduled board meeting was for early January, and I think they thought it would be more prudent to wait until then, and frankly, I think they thought it would be a nicer thing to do.
Do you say that they formally took the action in November?
No, Your Honor. They took, It was characterized as a straw poll. I mean, essentially, they took a straw poll and said, yes, we should terminate this person. And the testimony in the record indicates that some of the board members voted on the decision on the day that it was carried out, but that others knew in advance that that was the likely thing that would happen in January. Let's go to the idea that the private and public actors can be held accountable under Section 1983 on the basis that the state actors encouraged Ms. Spencer's termination for unconstitutional reasons. I have not found a case, and Ms. Spencer didn't cite a case, where both the joint action theory and the commanded or encouraged theory were both addressed in the same case. And I suspect they may be two different ways of saying essentially the same thing, because no matter how much encouragement the state actors could offer, unless there is an action based on that encouragement, i.e. an agreement or an understanding, a meeting of the minds, that encouragement does not result in the action. And therefore, neither the private nor public actors could be held liable under Section 1983. But even if commanded or encouraged is a separate viable theory, distinct from joint action, which is the one that this court has applied in similar situations, even if the encouraged standard is a separate viable theory, it's not supported here. You heard what the supposed evidence of encouragement is here. And the thing that I would really like to stress here is that nothing in the record indicates that the state threatened to withhold any funds, let alone threatened to withhold funds unless Carol Spencer was terminated. On the contrary, what the state official said is that certain federal funds would likely be withheld or held back while this dispute was percolating and until the federal government resolved what it was going to do about this dispute over the carryover of certain federal funds. As for the timing of Ms. Spencer's termination in January of 1998 and the release of funds, the timing is perfectly explainable. It was on January 7th that the DECA officials, the state officials, learned that the federal government would be releasing these funds. They, in turn, turned around and informed the association that the funds would be released. So it had everything to do with the fact that the federal government said, we're releasing funds to you now, state of Illinois officials, and nothing to do with the fact that the association had a board meeting scheduled then, and that's the board meeting at which Carol Spencer was informed of her termination. The other things that Ms. Spencer cites as circumstantial evidence that the public actors encouraged her termination to the point where it can be attributed to the public actors amounts to the types of things that this court has repeatedly said in the Title VII context and other contexts the court isn't going to give much weight to. The court is not going to sit as a super personnel department. So whether the contingency budget was tabled, I don't think carries a whole lot of weight. And it would also make sense that that budget would be tabled in light of the fact that Spencer was being terminated. In contrast to the circumstantial and very tenuous supposed evidence that the state so encouraged this action to make it state action, the state officials here, Warner and Reidinger, knew that they had no business trying to influence personnel decisions, and there's testimony in the record to that effect. And they explicitly didn't try to do anything to get Carol Spencer fired, let alone try to get her fired for unconstitutional purposes. Additionally, all of the association officials testified that the state officials did not influence their decision in any way. And 7 out of the 11 who voted to terminate Carol Spencer would have voted to terminate her before any of her allegedly protected speech took place. They had long-standing issues with her over the relationship that she had with board members. She rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, to put it bluntly. From a policy standpoint, to find Section 1983 liability here, I think, to adopt Spencer's view of the world would mean that no state official could ever express dissatisfaction with a private employee without running the risk of setting up both the public actors and the private actors for Section 1983 liability. And here, Warner and Reidinger admitted, yes, we were upset with Carol Spencer. She accused us of breaking federal law. Her accusations resulted in us having to write a big report and do a bunch of paperwork. We were mad at her. But the mere fact that they were mad at her doesn't convert the private actor's decision to terminate her into state action. I'd like to also address for a moment whether or not her speech was even protected to begin with. And I think, Judge Coffey, you were perhaps alluding to this in your question to counsel earlier. Here, in order for her speech to be protected under the First Amendment to begin with, she has to be speaking as a private citizen on a matter of public concern. And under the applicable case law, such as this court's Euchre decision, she was not. She was speaking in the context of her job as executive director and spokesperson for the Illinois Community Action Association. And because she was speaking in that context, her speech is not protected to begin with. So even if you could show that there was an unconstitutional purpose and that all of the board members voted to terminate her because they colluded with the public actors to do so, it doesn't matter because her speech wasn't protected to begin with. Additionally, as counsel alluded to this morning, her speech was very disruptive of the operations of the association and its important relationship with DECA. And under other case law, if the speech would, even if it would be otherwise protected by the First Amendment, where it's as disruptive as it was here, it loses any First Amendment protection that it might otherwise have. For these reasons and those cited in our brief, I ask the court to please affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thank you, both counsel. The court will take this case under advisement and proceed to case number 2, please. Beach versus Sheik. Sheiks.